Welcome back to Insights for Health, the special one-hour edition on COVID-19 Insights. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Dr. Ira Bernstein. And Doctor, before the break, we talked about different preventions, different treatments that can be provided early in the process. And there's a phrase, Doctor, called long-haul COVID. Can you just describe to us what's going on there?
Sure. So long-haul COVID represents persons who've had COVID-19, the disease caused by SARS-CoV-2, they've technically recovered, meaning they don't have active infection. However, some patients continue to have ongoing symptoms, and it could be very diverse. Fatigue, brain fog, shortness of breath, generalized weakness, many, many symptoms that can persist for many, many months. And currently, there's no generally accepted standard of care for treatment of long-haul COVID. What we have discovered, what some scientists have discovered, is some of the medications that we use to treat COVID with these repurposed medications can also be used to treat some of the long-haul symptoms. So this is quite fortunate. What's thought to be the case is, again, it's pertaining to the immune system and likely related to the spike protein. It's thought that there is persistence of the spike protein from the virus that is still circulating within certain cells of the blood, specifically the monocytes. So there are treatments to help remove the spike protein and the ongoing inflammation that may be persisting in certain individuals. And that's why I said, if you treat COVID early, you're not going to end up with the long-haul COVID symptoms. So this is important to know.
In the beginning of the COVID over in New York State, they really took a beating. There was a Dr. Zelenko who treated patients, and he had a standard of care for early treatment. Can you talk about Dr. Zelenko and what he was doing and the results of his application of those treatments?
Sure. Dr. Zelenko is a family physician in New York. Have to call him a real pioneer and hero during this pandemic for coming up with a protocol. And others have come up with similar protocols, like Dr. Raoult in France. And his protocol involved treating, higher risk patients. He didn't treat everybody, but he treated those with comorbidities, those who are of increased age. And of course, this was all pertaining to the original Wuhan strain of the virus, not the Delta strain. The protocol involved hydroxychloroquine, the antibiotic azithromycin plus zinc. And like you said, he and his group have treated thousands of patients, and their success rate was absolutely incredible. And again, there were those who vilified him, saying, you know, not published data and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's always, you know, excuses. It's anecdotal. You haven't done this. It's not a randomized controlled trial. But his actions and results really speak for themselves. So you have to give him credit. He is well recognized amongst the treating physician community, highly regarded and qualified, especially since he was quite ill himself, battling cancer. He got COVID-19 as well during this.
We discussed briefly in previous segments about the censoring of voices, where there are renowned researchers, scientists, doctors, who, when they seem to speak against what the government narrative is, they become deplatformed off of social media. They're dismissed as not knowing what they're talking about. They're disciplined. People are threatened. Naturopaths were ordered in the beginning from their association not to speak of the immune system related to SARS-CoV-2. Holistic nutritionists receive the same type of order. You yourselves are censored. I don't understand that. You know, there's a saying that in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. They're coming up with mandates and protocols that seem contradictory to everything you are saying. But why aren't there a multitude of disciplines sitting around the table coming up with a standard of treatment like you're describing as step one, step two, step three, and with a few variations perhaps? Why not the vitamin D? Can you speak to that in any way? Like, I don't want to put you in a corner here either. I know you have a certain censorship applied to you.
Well, you know, there's no money in vitamin D, or really any of the nutrients. They're off-patent, inexpensive, and much of what's going on is based on certain financial interests. You know, from a clinician's point of view, really makes no sense at all. it's quite disturbing. And these are concepts that really I could never have imagined in my lifetime would be happening. None of it makes sense. The censorship from YouTube and Facebook, it's very concerning. Video about ivermectin on YouTube is gone, deleted as misinformation. This is nothing to do with the vaccination program, or at least it shouldn't have anything to do with the vaccination program, because this isn't supposed to be competing with the vaccination program. An important notation regarding the vaccines, and more information is coming out all the time, that they are less efficacious than they were intended to be with breakthrough infections, meaning you get the vaccine and immunity wanes over a period of months, and so people are fully vaccinated are contracting the virus and still may end up hospitalized. The point is, whether you're vaccinated or not, patients require treatment. And I have treated patients who are fully vaccinated who've contracted COVID-19. And I've used these same medications. So care is care, whether you're vaccinated or not. And suppression of that is certainly not benefiting anybody. Suppression of that will lead to patient harm. When you look at care within the United States, I was just hearing this morning that the deaths from COVID-19 in the United States represent 25% of the world's deaths from COVID-19. And yet, the United States is supposed to have the most advanced healthcare system. And yet, more people per capita are dying in the United States from COVID-19 than any other country. Something is wrong here. You need to start asking questions. Why is this taking place? And what can we do about it? And that's why I'm here as an advocate who understands the science and who has good results with my patients, along with my colleagues who are also treating with good results. And we're here to share that information. We have nothing to gain. There's no conflicts of interest, like I said before. We have no financial affiliations with any company. And we just want the best care for our patient.
You have not lost a patient, have you?
I have not lost a single patient from COVID-19.
Something's working.
Yes, and some of the patients that have been referred to me have been quite ill, particularly with the Delta virus, and where they've been referred to me with fairly late presentations, and they've required aggressive treatments. These patients frequently, they say they don't want to go to the hospital. They're afraid that if they go to the hospital, they're going to be put on a ventilator and die. This is a real fear of patients. And also, when you end up in hospital, you don't get any of these treatments. There is no hospital that will use any of these treatments. No hospitals are using ivermectin or any of these other repurposed medications. None. I know of none. The hospitals are limited in what they are using. They're using dexamethasone, which is a steroid, which is fine. They're using anticoagulants to thin the blood because of the clotting processes involved. They're using oxygen. They're using remdesivir for reasons that really no one can understand because the data is quite poor. There's no mortality benefit at all from remdesivir. It costs over $3,000 for 5 days of treatment. It has a risk to the kidneys and liver. So not sure why hospitals are using that across North America. It makes no sense at all.
This should not be a vaccine alone approach. It does require a comprehensive approach from a multidisciplined group of professionals to combat this.
Absolutely. You know, if we vaccinate 100% of the population, there's still going to be COVID-19 because we know with the nature of the vaccine itself that it doesn't prevent infection, doesn't prevent transmission, that people are still going to contract COVID-19. So we need this multi-pronged therapeutics to help manage the pandemic. You know, they're telling you that, ivermectin is this, horse dewormer and shouldn't be used. I mean, that's a load of rubbish. It's been a human drug for decades.
And ivermectin is used in the veterinary world, but there is a human usage.
I'm not prescribing vet ivermectin. I'm writing prescriptions to be dispensed by a pharmacist, human-grade ivermectin, which is the way it should be done. But Canadians need access to the medications. They should not be shut off by people who really do not have a good understanding or may have other agendas. I'm not sure really what it is.
It's not a one-size-fits-all. There's a issue right now in Israel. My understanding is that at least 80% or more of the population is double vaxxed, yet those vaccinated people are contracting the Delta variant far greater than previous outbreaks. Did I understand that correctly?
I believe that is correct. Not only have they been double vaxxed, I think a few million or so have been triply vaxxed at this point, and yet They've had a very aggressive wave that has hospitalized many, many people who've been fully vaccinated. And this has been seen in other countries as well. It's seen in the UK, United States. You know, the concept that people have been told that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated is not true at all. I'm not saying don't get vaccinated. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying the vaccines are not providing that durable, robust protection. When the vaccines came out, you're told 95% efficacy. They think they are protected. But that was based also on the initial Wuhan strain. That's long gone. And keep in mind that the vaccines are based on the RNA of the original Wuhan strain. And that's why there is less protection against Delta. Not to take away from the importance of having safe and effective vaccines, I'm here to focus on treating those who are sick that will benefit from treatment when they contract COVID-19.
Doctor, it's been a real pleasure and a real privilege to have you on Insights for Health today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
After the break, Dr. Paul Alexander will give us a global view of the pandemic.
Joining us is Dr. Paul Elias Alexander. Dr. Alexander holds a PhD with graduate education from the University of Toronto, Oxford, and McMaster University, where he is a former assistant professor. He is also a former COVID pandemic advisor to the WHO and the Pan American Health Organization. Dr. Alexander has held positions with both the U.S. and Canadian governments and is currently a COVID-19 consultant researcher with the U.S. C-19 Research Group. Good morning, Dr. Alexander.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be on your program. My background academic training is graduate school at the University of Toronto in epidemiology, evidence-based medicine graduate research degree at Oxford in evidence-based medicine, and doctorate in evidence-based medicine research methodology at McMaster University.
You and a growing cohort of scientists, researchers, academics, and frontline doctors have concerns over the federal and provincial mandate regarding COVID-19.
Scientists can disagree, and we disagree all the time, clinicians, doctors, academic scientists. But normally there's an exchange of information, of ideas, you debate it, and there must be disagreement, but from that disagreement, knowledge grows, and you improve your understanding of the issue, evolves, and we share information and we update the science. But for COVID, something other than science has been at play from the beginning. What has happened is certain forces at play. They have shut out any discussion, any views that don't comport with their narrative, which is lock down the society, close schools, mask everyone, despite the fact that all of the science now, today, after 19 months, have shown it has all failed. That the vaccine does not stop the Delta variant.
There was a study in Sweden. Can you describe what that study revealed?
Well, that study was one of the seminal studies, along with many. That was done by a scientist called Ludvigsson and published in New England Journal of Medicine. What he published was this. He looked at 1.95 million Swedes, all of the Swedish children under the age of 16 since the beginning of the pandemic. And there were no lockdowns in Sweden, no school closures, no mask mandates. Children just went ahead. Children in primary school, kindergarten, whatever. They went to school as normal. And what they found across time in all of these children, there was no instance of death, zero. They also found very few instances of infection and likely infected from teacher to child. That was such a seminal, shocking study. There was another study out of the French Alps. The research group was Danes et al. They looked at one symptomatic positive patient, child. It was a young child. I think it was 9 years old. And they exposed about 120 kids and teachers. They did contact tracing. And they found in for that child who exposed so many and all of their contacts, they found not one instance of secondary transmission. None. The data has been available 15 to 18 months.
So there's some history regarding vaccines that went ahead without proper testing and safety guidelines. What was it that the dengue vaccine, the H1N1, had problems? That triple vax back in 1977
yes.
had issues. even all the way back to 1955 with the tainted polio.
You mentioned the dengue vaccine. So this was a vaccine that was developed, I think it was rolled out in 2017 in the Philippines. The result was a condition called, I think, plasma leakage syndrome, and it was catastrophic to children. That vaccine had to be pulled. I think Pfizer, the same company right now bringing these mRNA, brought a vaccine in, I think, a few years ago called Trovan, T-R-O-V-A-N for meningitis. And I believe they rolled it out in Nigeria, and many children died. They had to stop it, and they're still paying those families and the government right now. There was the H1N1 2009 for that pandemic. The vaccine that they pulled out caused narcolepsy and a host of conditions for children, again, and adults. There was the 1955 Qatar lab incident you're talking about with the polio, with the tainted vaccine. It caused catastrophic harm to people for decades. Some are still alive. Principally, with these mRNA vaccines, they have been trying for the last decade, decade and a half, to bring these vaccines. They have looked at it in coronaviruses. And what has happened in the past is, when they conducted the studies in animals, in the mice, in the ferrets, etc., they found that when they introduced these vaccines to the animals, they built a good immune response, high antibody levels, etc. But when the animals were challenged with the real virus, the wild-type virus, or even common colds, just mild common colds in the wild, which are common colds for coronaviruses, the animals got very sick. There was a lot of lung inflammation, and liver toxicity, and many of the animals died. And because of that, those studies were not allowed to be moved forward. So they were never able to take the studies into the human model. And now we have them using these vaccines in human beings now in emergency use. But my understanding from reading what has been put out there already by the vaccine developers and to the FDA, etc., is that they've not done the safety studies. They've not used the proper animal models. I think they were supposed to use at least one non-human primate. They have not. They've not conducted the proper genetotoxicity studies, teratogenicity studies, reproductive toxicity studies, pharmacodynamic studies, pharmacokinetic studies. These are the types of studies that have to be run long-term, and they will properly assess safety for those even rare safety signals that emerge across time. Principally also, we don't have the studies to tell us how much of the messenger RNA that these vaccines take up, how much spike protein is being produced, where exactly it's being produced, etc., for how long, and all of these very important questions. We got a glimpse of a problem where when Pfizer approached the Japanese government to put the vaccine out into Japan, the Japanese government didn't believe Pfizer and that the vaccine was effective and safe, and requested that Pfizer do a biodistribution study so that they could see where the content of the vaccine is going. And what shocked everyone and actually started this very focused debate, led a lot by a good scientist coming out of Guelph University in Canada, Dr. Byron Brittle, was that, and he broke this news that somebody leaked that biodistribution, bioaccumulation study. When the vaccine is introduced into the deltoid, into the arm, the idea was and the assumption was that the content of the vaccine stays localized to the arm, and the deltoid muscle moves around to the local lymph drainage nodes, and your immune response takes place right there at the level of the arm. You know, you get a tetanus vaccine, the tetanus bolus stays there, your immune response works there, things get dissolved, come out into your feces in time, but your immune response happens there. What this biodistribution study showed, the Japanese one in animals, was that about 75% of the content of the vaccine leaves the arm, the deltoid area, and enters the bloodstream. That was not supposed to happen, because what is happening there is the lipid nanoparticles that carries the messenger RNA, which is the payload, gets delivered and accumulates. We saw it was accumulated in some very vital tissue and organs, such as the testes in males, the ovaries in females, the spleen, the adrenals, evidence that it crossed the blood-brain barrier. It was followed up by a study by Ogata and colleagues from Harvard that showed that in, I think, 13 healthcare workers who took the vaccine, and about 11 of them immediately, maybe 1 hour after, for at least 2 weeks, spike protein was found in the bloodstream. Things that were happening, things have happened that were not supposed to happen. We found out, because of this breaking news by Brittle, that the spike protein itself, very, very good research by Dr. Patrick Whelan, Dr. Brittle, Dr. Charles Hoff from Canada, Dr. Mark Trozzi, these people, Dr. Mike Eden, Dr. Robert Malone, who's the pioneer for the mRNA technology, Dr. Mike Eden, who headed up Pfizer, Dr. Gerd van den Bosch. I work with all of these people. And what we've found out now is that the spike protein, which is the business end of the virus, is what causes the pathology in serious COVID disease. You know, this month now, that spike protein that we're injecting into you, the mechanism to build it, or even if it comes in the adenoviral vector platform via DNA, etc., that spike protein is the actual pathogen. We are actually injecting into you the part of this virus that is devastating to the endothelial layer of the vasculature. That is the cells that line the inner lining of your vascular, of your vessels, that your arteries, veins, capillaries. It damages the vasculature, it causes trauma, initiates blood clotting and bleeding, etc. So we know this, so we understand now this process better, and we understand the risks to the vaccine. And we have been pleading with the vaccine developers and the FDA in the United States and Health Canada, you need to put a pause because of the people who have died. You need to stop this discussion about vaccinating children, and we need you to go back to the lab and study the safety part, which you did not do. Get that safety information down so that people could be properly informed of the risk, because you're not being informed of the risk. Also, we are asking governments like the Canadian government, like the United States government, to for the first time collect the safety information so we can properly care for the people who've been harmed by these vaccines. We don't have proper data safety monitoring boards post-vaccine for the public when you get a shot. We don't have the proper ethics review committees. We don't have the critical event committees. These things were part of the registrational trials, but then stopped. So we have implemented a vaccine program, a rollout, and we're not collecting the data as to what happens post-vaccine. We're not collecting it rigorously and comprehensively. So people just don't know. Five Nordic countries have now put a pause, not pause, stop. That is such a serious step. But five European countries, remember, the FDA has already had black box warnings on Pfizer and Moderna in terms of myocarditis and CVSD, cerebral vascular sinus thrombosis. So we know that these vaccines cause harm. If you look at any of those places, clinics that give these shots, you see outside of them there's an ambulance park. Why? Where have you ever seen that before? Because as part of these submissions, the governments had to understand that you need to have available a rapid response team when you give these vaccines, because they cause anaphylactic shock. You must have a medical support team available wherever you're administering them to revive people, etc. Have you ever seen that before? And that's something you need to ask. Why are these ambulances and paramedics hanging around here? I just came for a simple shot. But they're hanging around there for you.
Thank you for joining us on Insights for Health.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to both my guests, Dr. Paul Alexander and Dr. Ira Bernstein. And thank you for listening. It's unfortunate that we couldn't question that third point of view. As is often the case when finding answers, we discover new questions, such as, why isn't there open debate? Why the censoring of qualified voices and questions that have arisen from scientific observation and evidence? Why aren't all the relevant parties at the table? Why are treatments being restricted? And why weren't we publicly informed of proactive prevention? Isn't this about the overall health of everyone? Our knowledge and wisdom should be stability in these times. But without the truth of evidence, it warps our society, causing greater harm. It's not too late to adjust our trajectory and land on our feet. Let all the parties meet together in mutual respect, and together achieve a comprehensive plan to move forward for the optimal health and wellness of everyone, and not a one-size-fits-all with coercion. My final question is to all of us. After everything you've heard, have you come to a conclusion? Or do you have more questions?